Here we go. Listeners, welcome back to Black Talk, or welcome if you are a first-time listener. My name is Michelle Simpson, and I have the pleasure of hosting Black Talk, the show that centers Black voices, Black thought, and Black vision. And speaking of vision, imagine having the vision to summit to the top of the world. So with that, I am delighted to introduce my guest, Eddie Taylor. And for those of you who don't know, Eddie is a member of Full Circle. Full Circle is a group of Black climbers and mountaineers. So Eddie, correct me if I have any of this wrong. The members of Full Circle made an expedition to Mount Everest, and spoiler alert, everyone, on 12 May, seven members of Full Circle successfully reached the summit. Am I correct?
Yeah.
So Eddie, when you're not summiting the world's tallest mountain, I understand you are a chemistry teacher and a track and field coach at Centaurus High School in Lafayette.
Yep.
So how did you end up there?
Well, I moved to Boulder about 10 years ago.
Okay.
I guess a little longer than 10 years ago, 15 years ago now, actually.
All right. Time flies.
Yeah. I always forget those last couple of years of COVID and everything.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I went to University of Colorado. I ran on the track team there, and I really liked and enjoyed being around here and in the mountains and being near to all the outdoor activities, and just wanted to stay.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, you know, one of the questions I have for you is, and this is in keeping with how I'm understanding your story, as I understand it, one of your desires in joining Full Circle and joining the expedition is to inspire other Black folks' interests in the outdoors. Could you say more about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you really look at the basics of the expedition, the leader, Phil Henderson, is the guy who invited me along on the project. I met him randomly in Western Colorado.
Okay, and, is he here in Colorado, Phil Henderson?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he lives in Cortez, so 7-8 hours away,
okay,
but still in the state. But I met him randomly in Western Colorado, and he had been going to Nepal every year for the past 20 years or something like that. And he basically is known as one of the only Black people in Nepal, because there's not a lot of Black people who not just climb Everest, but even travel to that region of the world.
Got it. And
so he wanted to bring his community from the US there to kind of see the magic that place has. Mm-hmm. And also so that, like, we can go back and share those stories in our own communities, kind of like what we're doing here right now. And so that was kind of the impetus for that, for the project.
Okay. And, got it. You know, yeah. There is, and you may have noticed this as well, there has been a decided emphasis, if you will, these days on asking the question, why don't more Black people spend time outdoors? Why don't more Black people hike, ski, climb, swim, camp, mountain bike, you name it. What is your response to that question?
I mean, I think it's obviously, like anything, there's a lot of layers to it.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of in our communities, it hadn't been something that we traditionally did. And so, I mean, climbing is the thing that I'm closest to, but when I got into climbing and I was interested in it, I didn't know anyone who looked like me who did it.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, it is what it is. A lot of things I've done growing up, and kind of, like, I was the only Black kid in my high school. And then I went to CU, which was a very not diverse school as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten good at doing sports and doing different things in my life where everyone doesn't look like me. But I think that kind of as Black people, we don't really have a heritage in these sports, in hiking, in camping. And even when you look at the media, like if you Google climbing, you Google hiking, you Google camping, you're going to see families that don't look like us. It's starting to change a little bit, but if you can't even see yourself doing that and no one in your community does that, it's going to be really hard to start doing these sports.
Right. You know, and I think also in order to answer that question fully, we have to acknowledge the reasons Black folks often feel unsafe in the out of doors, which is a truism.
Yeah.
How were you introduced to the outdoors, outdoor activities?
So when I grew up, I lived in a lot of different places. I spent my summers with my dad in Chicago, and then I spent the rest of the year with my mom in different Native American reservations around the country. Mm-hmm. And when we moved out to the Southwest, I moved to New Mexico, and well, we weren't around family. We weren't around kind of our community. And my mom was trying to figure out what to do. And she was like, hey, well, there's a lot of national parks. We can go see these. And so we started going every weekend to like the Grand Canyon and Monument Valley and things like that. And we all kind of just learned together how to go on hikes and camp and things. And I can't say I loved it when I was that age, when I was, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. But after moving to Boulder and starting to spend more time outdoors kind of later in life, I really appreciated that.
Yeah. And it sounds like it's part of the fabric of your story. So even if at that age you weren't necessarily, you know, enthusiastic about it, it was still kind of part of what you did. And as you said, part of what you saw. I know for me, for example, I grew up in New York. I grew up close to a massive beach. And Black folks definitely took advantage of that space. But in preparation for speaking to you today, I began thinking that even though Black people were on the beach, I don't remember seeing many diving or swimming or surfing. I think the idea was, to be honest with you, just arriving by car or bus or train, the beach seemed like an act of resistance. In other words, getting to the beach and being on the beach was an act of resistance in and of itself. And then staking one's umbrella into the sand was a way of declaring that the beach belonged to us too. When I moved to Colorado, I was determined to engage in what I thought were Colorado activities. So initially that meant for me going camping. And I remember while getting ready for camping and having to buy all this gear because I didn't own any, neither did the people I was going with. But I remember working really hard to find a campsite where we didn't have to interact with other people, more specifically white people. I wanted to avoid, in my mind, in my imagination, reenacting any scenes from Deliverance or the white supremacist version of that particular movie. And I remember also that on the way into the mountains, we passed vehicles that proudly were displaying Confederate flags. And I wanted to put as much distance between us and those who might be relitigating the Civil War vibe anywhere near our campsite. So, you know, it's interesting because getting back to a point I made earlier, I think there are very few Black people alive who aren't aware of the fact that devastatingly horrible things have happened to Black people in what is referred to as the great outdoors. In other words, the great outdoors was often the site of lynchings, rapes, murders, cross burnings. And so thinking about just the nature of the slave trade, for example, back to the ocean and the water and its relationship to water, there are Black people who have a very ambivalent relationship to the water. And I know that from having lived in Jamaica, West Indies for so many years, and people's sense of the water or safety around water, or just overall, as I said, kind of relationship to it. And stories they were told. So yeah, there's some obstacles there. And Eddie, I wanted to ask you, because you work with young people, and just by, again, what you're modeling in your life as a climber, as a mountaineer, how do you persuade, or how do you think we can persuade or inspire Black folks who point to someone like Ahmaud Arbery, who at 25 years old was just outside for a jog, so he was outside, who was wrongly confronted, shot, and killed? I know that's a big question, lots of different parts, but again, we don't want to live in a state of fear. I get that. But when I talk to younger people, for example, and I talk about some of these things, whether it's camping or just visiting, you know, a national park or going up in the mountains or hiking, biking, whatever that looks like. Not that I'm this big adventurer, because I'm not. But even when I speak to some of those things, I can get these looks and I know the look. In other words, I know it because I've had it at times myself and had the same response. So I just wonder, you know, when and if you have these conversations, you know, how do you approach them?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had a ton of these conversations, to be honest. I mean, yeah, a lot of these things are dangerous. Going outside is dangerous. I mean, but being in a city is dangerous, right? Like I'm more likely to be pulled over than I am to fall off a mountain, you know, and I do that literally every weekend. I'm a lot more scared to be pulled over by a cop. I mean, that's just the reality of it.
Yeah. And
cops aren't walking 10 miles in the backcountry. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I was saying earlier about a lot of, I think Black people don't do it because there's not a lot of people in our community out there hiking and doing all these outdoor activities. But, and it really is just it's a Black people in the US problem, because like I went and spent a lot of time in Kenya climbing, and there's a lot of Black people out there guiding, leading, being in charge of these climbs, out there recreating. And so that's really not a Black person problem as much more of a like Black people in the US because of, you know, everything that we've had. And where, like, you know, our communities have been pushed into the cities and things like that, and haven't felt safe in small town, rural America, where a lot of the good hikes are, a lot of the good climbs are, a lot of those type of things. So I don't necessarily think it's an inherent nature problem, but it's just a, you know, people in the US tensions, yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And part of our legacy, you know, yeah. Here in the United States, which makes sense. You know what I think, and you can tell me if you see this similarly. It seems that since we've been in the throes, and we're still in the throes of the pandemic, that in some ways the pandemic has been good for, and I'm kind of using quotes, listeners, has been good for moving Black folks outdoors. I think just having to kind of quarantine and having to shelter at home, I think it got old. And so as a result, I think people in cities, for example, kind of started to venture out more into some of the parks that were close by, or some of the kind of other environments that were close by, and people in rural areas or people who were closer. I don't know if that's been your experience, you know, or if you think the pandemic in some ways kind of shifted things just a bit. I'm not saying monumentally necessarily, but started to shift things a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think the pandemic's just made everyone start to value being outside a lot more. And also, I think, like, this is a kind of a personal example, but I've been climbing pretty heavily for the past 10, 12 years. And I've climbed with less than probably 5 Black people. Mm-hmm. And kind of during the pandemic, unfortunately, like, forced me to like sit and be on my computer more and things like that. And I didn't even have social media before the pandemic. And so kind of, as I started being a little more active on social media, I started connecting with different groups and different people around the country, because I mean, our Everest expedition, we had 11 Black people that were skilled, talented, had the skills and ability to climb Everest. Mm-hmm. And I mean, before that, like, most people in the group didn't even know that there was that many people. And there probably is more people that have the skills and abilities and have been amassing them over the past, who knows how many years, but like from conversations I've had, most Black people who are climbing at a higher level feel like they're the only one.
Got it. Because there's sounds like there's some isolation there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of isolation. Mm-hmm.
But you know, now there are, and you probably, when you were talking about various groups and so forth, now there are more and more affinity groups. You know, Outdoor Afro, for example, is one of the largest networks, I think, of outdoor recreation groups for Black people. And I know that they're at least 12 years old at this point, and they're located in over 56 cities across the country. And, you know, it's interesting because I know that there is a Colorado, and I'm afraid I don't know their name, but it's a Black women's hiking group. And part of their story was they went out on a hike and someone called, I guess, the sheriff's department, and called the sheriff's department on them and said they were taking up too much space.
Well, I think it's like Vibe Tribe or something.
Okay. Yeah. But they were taking up too much space on the trail. And I think they were also referred to as a mob. But much to their credit and resilience and determination to keep going, they kept going, you know, after after kind of focusing on that. I don't know if you're familiar with Baratunde Thurston. He's a sometime comedian, writer, Black PBS host, and he's quoted as saying, going out for a jog, sleeping in our own beds, or going fishing on a lake, all of this is our right, and in some ways, our obligation. And I just wanted to ask you, I wanted to get back to the climb. I wanted to get back to kind of summiting Everest. Is Full Circle a new group?
It's been an idea of Phil Henderson's for a long time, but like this group of people who went and did Everest, I mean, that was a trip that was 3 years in the making.
Okay. And tell me again, so it sounds like Phil Henderson was the one who was instrumental in getting this going, but was there, or did Phil Henderson have a predecessor? In other words, how did it get started?
So Phil's been climbing for the past 30 years, and that's a lot longer than me or anyone on the team has been. And I kind of talked about being like in isolation and the only one. And so really this trip's been put together by kind of the Black people that he's met and had good climbing experiences with over that past amount of time. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of finally gotten to the point where he's like, oh, I can put a whole team together and it would be really cool to take this trip to Nepal and to Everest. Mm-hmm. And so it was really his idea. And he just started bringing people on the team. And then at some point we were pretty close to the trip actually happening. And that's kind of when I met him. And we still were at the point where we have the idea. We have a bunch of people who are interested, but we really didn't have funding because Everest, like, it's not just a hard climb. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we started putting together our pitch deck and different things. We're talking with brands that different folks had connections with and kind of letting this trip become a little more public and kind of more, a lot bigger than just a climbing trip. Mm-hmm. Because like I've went on lots of really cool and interesting climbing trips, but it's always been something that I do. And then I just share the stories with my close friends. And we wanted to make sure that this trip had a little bit bigger of an impact. And so that's why we were in schools. We were doing different presentations from the mountain and really trying to show basically not only inspire other people of color, but also, you know, show that like this is something that Black people do too. And it doesn't have to be like, you know, people don't have to give you the stare because they see you hiking out on a trail, who knows where, or you're camping, kind of what you were talking about, right? Like, like it's just like white people go play basketball, Black people go play basketball, or baseball, or any of those other sports that this happened with 100 years ago. It's completely okay for us to do these outdoor activities as well.
You know, Eddie, how I first heard about you was through some friends and their kids were privy, I think, to you coming to their school and or other members of Full Circle coming to their school and talking about the expedition. What kind of reception did you get from the kids?
The kids are really excited. I mean, they're really excited to talk about Everest and talk about what a trip looks like. And like, since I've been back, you know, this is my third week of school, so I haven't seen a lot of kids since before I left, and they're really excited. Before the trip, I didn't talk about my personal climbing at all in the classroom. Very little. Like, the kids didn't hear about it till it came out in this little magazine that they read for school called Newsella. And so all the ninth graders that read it in their English class and were like, hey, that's
wait
my
a minute.
Teacher.
Yeah. So tell me about the brands. I don't need to know names and that kind of thing necessarily, but what was their draw? What was their draw for supporting and or funding, you know, this expedition?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of a much bigger story than almost the expedition. No, the expedition was really cool, but around, I guess it's the timing seems weird, but around 2 years ago, we didn't have any money at all. Mm-hmm. Like, this was a great idea. This was a great trip. There's a lot of people that wanted to be on it, but we didn't have any money. And we talked to different brands and right away, people weren't that interested. They're like, why is this different? People do Everest all the time. Why is this important? Our very first sponsor was a smaller company and they were like, this is a great idea. Like, especially when I started bringing stats that at that time, I only thought 6 Black people had done Everest. And now it's up to 10 before we went. Mm-hmm. But there's been 10,000 summits and only 10 of those have been Black people in the entire world, not just you, you know, African Americans. Yeah. So like seeing that disparity, like the first brand, they were really small. They're like, hey, like if us supporting you helps this thing go, and we really want to. I mean, a lot of big companies are all about, like, they're happy to invest in these different types of trips and projects, but they're all about the return on investment. And we're all outdoors people. None of us are people that are in marketing. And so like, well, what's our return on investment? And, you know, we kept trying to say, like, this is a trip that will help change the industry. And it's going to help give, you know, validity to another demographic of people. And also, like, you see that these different movements in other parts of the world and the nation, but if you keep telling these same stories, it's not going to make it a more inclusive place for other folks. And so it really took till we did a GoFundMe and we started raising money that way, that a lot of the bigger brands started seeing that not just we thought it was important, but the outdoor industry at large thought it was important, or the consumers. And so then a lot of brands really started reaching out, and we hit our budget pretty fast after our GoFundMe launched.
Well, that's wonderful. And yeah. Did they provide money as well as equipment?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of times at working with brands, they want you to use their equipment. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword where we get equipment from them, but they also get publicity, right? Like every single shot or every single photo, there's also going to be a movie about this project. You know, their brand's going to be pictured there. So we got a lot of equipment. We also got, mm-hmm. We got funding and just a lot of support to go on the trip.
So tell me, well, wait a minute. Stop right there. There's a film. Tell me about the film.
So the film, I have no idea when it's going to come out, to be honest. But once we went public, a lot of people were really interested in filming the project or making some type of docuseries or miniseries. Mm-hmm. And kind of early on, again, before we had funding, we talked to one of the guys in our group had some friends that were filmmakers, and they do a pretty good job. And they were trying to get funding for the whole time we were doing it to film this project because they thought it was really important.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
And so about a week before we left, we finally got our production company partner, which is Westbrook.
Okay.
And Westbrook, it's actually Will and Jada's company.
Okay.
They came out with King, well, I'm spacing.
King Richard.
Mm-hmm. So that, yeah. They did mm-hmm. King Richard. They uh-huh. also did Cobra Kai. So kind of two completely different type of popular films. And mm-hmm. so hopefully they'll do a really good job with our Everest movie.
So wait a minute, Eddie, who's playing you? Michael K. Jordan or who?
It's just a documentary. They kind of, you know, shot pieces here and there, shot some stuff at base camp.
Okay.
Came with us. Okay. A little before and after the expedition. So
well, that is exciting though. That is exciting. Yeah. Keep us posted as to when it actually airs so we can bring you back. We can talk about that. So was it always the intention of the Full Circle team? Was it always the intention of the group to summit Mount Everest, or was it to put kind of Black mountaineers, climbers together and do something? Or was it initially the idea to summit Everest?
I think initially it was the idea to summit Everest.
Okay.
Yeah. Phil just wanted to bring his community to Nepal. And then he just thought that this would be one of the best stages to, you know, take a really skilled all Black team and go try to summit Everest.
Got it. So how was the team actually formed?
Very just interesting meetings. Like I said, I met Phil at the dog park in Eureka, Colorado.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a small little town where there's lots and lots of ice climbing, and there's very, very few. I don't know if there's any Black people that live there. And we both just happened to be visiting, happened to be ice climbing, saw each other over the weekend, traded numbers, and then went skiing a few weeks later. And he told me about his project, and we had talked about our backgrounds, and he thought I'd be a perfect fit to mm-hmm. Join the Full Circle project. And that's kind of how all the meetings were. I mean, he met two of the other members at Uray 2 years ago, and one of those members is from Seattle and one was from Bozeman. A couple other of the members, KG, who's actually from Kenya, they used to work together 20 years ago for mm-hmm. Knowles, the National Outdoor Leadership School. So it's kind of, there wasn't any like formal interview process or anything like that. It was just basically a bunch of people who knew each other coming together to do this project.
Okay. And people were coming from all across the country, it sounds like?
Yeah.
Okay. What would you say, Eddie, was different or unique about your summiting team, except for the obvious? I mean, it's an all Black team, but what else do you think made this particular group, made Full Circle unique?
I think a couple things. Yeah, one, the obvious, it's all mm-hmm. Black team. Mm-hmm. Another that, I mean, everyone in this, in our group, and I don't really want to speak to other people's expeditions, but everyone in our group was very skilled, very talented, and it's been climbing for a long time.
Okay.
And so we did a lot of things to make sure to have very high margins of success. There's a part in the mountain, lower down the mountain, called the Icefall. And we basically said, hey, people on our team need to get through the Icefall in 10 hours because it's dangerous. And you, if you spend more time in there, there's more chance that something happens. Where other teams, you would see, like, they would, them and their Sherpa guides would spend 16, 17 hours getting through the Icefall. We were just trying to keep very, very low, as low risk as possible. Another thing we did was that we had weekly Zoom meetings the entire year.
Okay.
I guess that's a relic of the pandemic, that Zoom's a thing, but our whole team, we got on, we met each other. We really got to know each other well through that entire year, because a lot of expeditions, they show up to Everest and that's the first time they're meeting everyone, or they're showing up to,
right,
to Kathmandu.
I've read that. Yeah. I've read that.
Yeah. So we all kind of knew each other. We went on a couple pre-trips. I had everyone, not everyone, but mostly everyone on the team came over to my house 2 weeks before we left, and we skied in Colorado and mm-hmm. went hiking in Chautauqua.
Okay.
I think just really having that good relationship going into a big trip and mountain like that just made everything go way smoother. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone just got along. There was no issues with, I believe this, you come from here. You know what I mean? Like, we all mm-hmm. knew each other really well going into it. And I think that is just different for an expedition, especially one of this size.
You are listening to Black Talk on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Introduction to an Everest expedition was like many people's, through Into Thin Air by John Krakauer. You know, that's the book I read, and I remember, you know, just kind of hanging off the edge, you know, not literally, but figuratively as I was reading it. You're familiar with that book, I'm sure. So yeah, that's what I know. Well, you know, I have to ask you about Full Circle's relationship to the Sherpas who accompanied you on the climb. Did you have any say over who was going to accompany you? Were you assigned a particular cadre of Sherpas? What did that look like? What did that feel like? And how did you approach it? Because I have always felt, just even in reading articles and in reading John Krakauer's book and so forth, that it's such an important relationship, but I'm not always certain about how those relationships are formed when I think in terms of kind of hierarchies, you know, race, class, just the whole thing, you know, that may arise in developing those relationships. So I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Sherpas are the people who live in the Khumbu Valley, and everyone who works on Everest are not all Sherpas. Mostly everyone's Nepali. Going back to Phil's relationship with the region, he's been there over the past 20 years. And he actually thought it was important that before we went to Everest, that we came and helped out at the climbing school. Mm-hmm. And so in January, I took 3 weeks off of work and flew to Nepal and flew into the Khumbu and hiked halfway up to Everest base camp to this town called Fortse. Then every year they have a climbing school that was started. I don't remember when it was started, but I think about 15 years ago. And the goal of the climbing school is to empower the Sherpas and give them skills so that they can be safe on the mountain. So here's an example. I was teaching the advanced class, and one of the Sherpas that I worked with, he had his harness and he had and you have these little ropes that come off your harness to attach yourself to the fixed lines on the mountain.
Okay.
And he doesn't know how to tie his knot. He's an incredibly skilled worker in terms of, like, he's very strong. He's been on the mountain many, many days. But those simple things that can help him be more self-sufficient, like tying his knot, he just has a knot, is not pre-tied, as well as some duct tape around it so that he never has to touch it again.
I see.
But, and so basically he worked for a guiding company who came over there, you know, employed him and then said, here you go, here's your stuff, use it, versus teaching him how to tie the knots, how to put those safety systems in place. And so that's what we were doing at the climbing school. And it was really cool because we were working along the Sherpas who have been, who are already skilled and who have been through that school or learned somewhere. We were working there to help them teach their next generation. Mm-hmm. And so when we came to Everest, we already had a good relationship with a lot of people, and a lot of the instructors wanted this year to work on our team, which was also really interesting. And so our team, we didn't really have a Western guide. That's kind of just how it works up there. Like, there's Western guides, there's Western climbers, and there's Nepali guides and Nepali climbers.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so typically Western guides do make more money than the Nepali guides, and Western companies do, because Western companies basically just pay Nepali companies to work for them. And so we didn't really have that go between of using a Western company. We contracted directly with people from Nepal, and really our majority of our Sherpa team was made up of people from Fort Say, the village that we spent a bunch of time in. And so what was cool also is I met the Sirdar. Sirdar is the head Sherpa.
Okay.
I met him before I even went to Nepal. He spends half the year in Golden now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, as one does. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he was able to get a visa, and so he can support his family, and his daughter's off in college. And so
I mean,
Nepal is just a really poor country, and they don't really have a lot of manufacturing. The only way they make money is people leave Nepal and work in other places or tourism. And so our Sirdar, you know, he's working in Golden at the restaurant there and a lawn service. And then he goes back home and then he works on Everest because that's how he can afford to send his kids to college. It's really it's kind of sad in a way. Just, you know, what we have versus what they have, and how happy they are, and how happy like Panuru was to work, you know, work the job that a lot of people in the US would not want to work.
You mentioned a moment ago, Eddie, that many of the guides, many of the Sherpas were interested in kind of working with you and working with your team, working with Full Circle. And that was because?
Phil's a great guy, I gotta say. So they've all had a relationship with them, and they were all just excited. I mean, a lot of people, they kind of see this parallel, you know, this parallel of like the Sherpa people kind of feel like a minority. They're from a poor country. And then they kind of see where there hasn't been a lot of Black people in Everest, and they want to help that happen and help see that change. And what, again, I can't speak for every Sherpa person or every person on the mountain, but a lot of people, like, they want more tourists. They want more people to come over. They want to share their home and open their home up. And also it helps them make money for themselves
and
living. Right. Like, if people don't go there, and not just to climb Everest, but if people don't go to the Khumbu Valley in that region, it means they have to leave that region and they have to go to Kathmandu. They have to go work in Qatar or somewhere else outside of the country. So it's kind of a weird juxtaposition there.
Okay.
And so on our Everest expedition, we employed a pretty large Sherpa team, but we also weren't putting extra work on them and weren't making them do things that there's stories of things that you hear about. We had a pretty minimal camp setup. We just had basic tents. We had a small cook tent where you see like some of these expeditions have these mega domes with golf course grass underneath that they bring in.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Flat screen TVs and bakeries and coffee shops. And they bring all of this stuff in there. And because it's a national park, they can't stay there all year. So they're bringing all of these goods in and they're taking them out. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are employing more people doing that way, but also, I don't know. It's just interesting.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it. No, it sounds pretty interesting from a number of perspectives, you know, environmentally, yeah. Just a whole host of things come up for me as you describe that. So I know that other Black folks have made the Everest climb, and you've referenced that a moment ago. Was yours the first all-Black group? So in other words, the other climbers had been individuals or individuals who were somehow embedded in other groups that were predominantly white groups?
Yeah, so like Phil was on Everest in 2012, and he was the only Black person out of a group of 15 people.
Okay.
From what I know, most other expeditions are like that. Mm-hmm. The first American woman, I'm spacing on her name right now, Sophia Dannenberg. Mm-hmm. She went and did it with she didn't do it with another group. It was just her.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Okay.
So she was the first African-American woman, I think first Black woman in the world actually to climb Everest. Mm-hmm. And so she just basically booked a private expedition. And so she had a Sherpa team and things, but it was just her. I don't think she was a part of a bigger group.
And she made it to the top?
And she made it to the top, yes.
Wow. And what's her name again?
Sophia Dannenberg.
Okay. Wow.
This was a little bit different in terms of that we planned the trip. We went as a team. We shared that story. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a guide that was outside of, you know, the Black community, mm-hmm. other than working with the Sherpa people. And right. So yeah, I can't say it was like the most special expedition that was this cutting edge thing, but I thought that it was really a really enjoyable experience and mm-hmm. a great, I don't know.
Yeah, of course. So tell us about your preparation.
So a lot of the preparation was fundraising and trying to make this thing actually happen.
Okay. So I've outside been, of the physical, there was the financial piece. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I mean, I've been climbing for a long time. I climb multiple days per week before work and after work. And, you know, me and my wife, pretty much every weekend we're out climbing, either mostly rock climbing, but sometimes we're climbing different peaks and mountains or skiing. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't do a lot of crazy things different for the preparation. Like I didn't just say all of a sudden, I want to climb Everest and start doing the Rocky Balboa montage or anything like that. I just kind of kept doing what I was doing. Uh-huh. And just slowly preparing and, you know, reading the route, getting the gear, getting to know the team better and things like that. So mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. That was your prep. You know, this may sound a little strange, but I'm somebody who's always fascinated by dreams. So when you slept on the mountain, do you recall any of your dreams?
I don't. And that was one thing that I was told. KG, one of our team members, he kind of was in charge of a lot of the safety things. And in the safety talk, he was telling us about how at altitude, you might have some weird dreams. And I never had any. Like, I can't even remember a single dream on the entire mountain. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the topics around breakfast every morning is talking about their dreams, okay. What was happening. And mm-hmm. it's like, I just went to sleep and felt like I woke up like 5 minutes later every night.
Okay. I was just curious about that. You know, just being, you know, at that altitude, all of that. I just wondered what that might do. So, okay, Eddie, you got to tell us, what were your first thoughts? Maybe words. Maybe it was movement. I don't know if you did a little dance. What did you do when you reached the top?
I didn't do a lot, honestly. It's like, I got to take a picture. My hands were really cold. So I got my camera out. And then, you know what happens when iPhones are really, really cold? Like it gets all blurry. And I just hoped that the picture worked. And mm-hmm. honestly, I was a little stressed when I was at the top. We went up on the very first good weather day of the year.
Okay.
And so it's kind of when you have a weather forecast, if you know it's going to be good in 2 or 3 days, you might as well go for it versus waiting a week when you don't know how mm-hmm. good the weather's going to be. Mm-hmm. And so when we started up on the summit day, there was a lot of people because it was the first good weather day and a lot of people had been waiting for it.
When you say a lot of people, like what?
Like close to 200.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So when you climb on your summit day, most people climb with a Sherpa. So it's one climber to one Sherpa. Okay. That's kind of something that most guided guide companies and just in general that they started doing after the big disasters and things like that. And so for some expeditions, the minute they arrive at Everest, they're already paired up with the Sherpa. We only did it for summit day. Mm-hmm. And so it's beneficial for us, obviously, to get us to the top. And it's also really beneficial for the Sherpas because the more summits they have, the more employable they are. Mm-hmm. The more clients they get to the top, the more employable they are. And so the Sherpas are really excited to, you know, be along with on summit day. And so we actually, on our expedition, like we paid for more oxygen for any of the Sherpas who wanted to go to the summit, mm-hmm. During the expedition, not just the ones that were paired with the clients.
Oh, that makes okay. Sense. Okay.
So we made sure, cause you know, we want them to be employable later. Like we don't want them to be like, oh, cause we were on this expedition, we didn't get a chance to go for the summit or anything like that. So we Got made it. Sure that they had oxygen for that. But anyways, I kind of detoured from your question. There was a lot of people, there was like 200 people. And so I left a little bit later, for a couple different circumstances, but basically on my way up, I ended up unclipping and passing majority of the entire group, but one other team member, Manoa, who left a bit earlier. Mm-hmm. And so he summited around 1 a.m. and I saw him as I was coming down, and I summited around 2 a.m. But the last probably hour and a half of the hike, you're on a pretty narrow ridge and it's really hard to pass people on that ridge.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
And that's where bottlenecks happen. That's where some of the crazy pictures you've seen in the past have happened. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to the top, my goal was to get back past where the bottleneck would be before the rest of the group came up.
I see.
And so that's kind of why I wasn't up there dancing or celebrating or taking photos or anything. I was like, okay, we made it. Let's get down before we have no problems.
Yeah, got it. Yeah. Well, what do you see when you're at the top? What do you see? What are you looking at?
Well, I summited in the dark, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But you could see China a little bit, okay, on the other side. So, uh-huh, you know, the summit borders Nepal and China.
Right.
There's actually a National Geographic weather station that they put up a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's like a moon lander or something that was up, okay, there just, uh-huh, off the summit. And then what was really cool, like, I didn't really notice it from the summit, but on the ridge getting to the summit is how high above the clouds we were. Mm-hmm. And you could see, mm-hmm, storms hundreds of miles away, just this orange pocket here, this orange pocket here, of just these thunderstorms, and they were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet below you. Wow. Hundreds of miles away. So that was kind of one of the coolest things I saw. Just you could see when the lightning was, and you could see exactly where everything was, and it was just so bright with all the sky, the stars in the sky up there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So what was the trajectory of this trip? In other words, when did you begin the climb? I know you reached the summit by May 12th, if I have, mm-hmm, that correct, but when did you start? When did you begin?
So I worked on April 1st so that my benefits could go through April.
Okay.
And then, cause I had to take some time off. But then I flew out of Denver April 2nd, took 3 days to get to Nepal. We spent a few days in Kathmandu, mm-hmm, and we actually met with the Nepali Youth Council and did a little program at the US Embassy. So it was kind of really cool to have that connection, yeah, beyond just the actual climbing trip. Mm-hmm. And getting to interact with the Nepali Youth Council and just how interested they were in America and in the climb and, yeah, you know, hoping that we love their city and their place. It was just a really, mm-hmm, cool thing. Mm-hmm. So we spent a couple of days in Kathmandu, and then I think April 8th, we flew into the Khumbu Valley. Mm-hmm. And from there, we actually, everyone took we were able to bring one extra person. And so my wife, because she was 3 months pregnant at the time, she didn't come, but my little sister did.
Okay.
So I hiked in with my little sister. A lot of people hiked in with their spouses, or a friend. And so they accompanied us, and we did 10 days to base camp.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How interesting. Wow.
And so, yeah, once we were at base camp, mm-hmm, you kind of have to acclimatize. You have to go up a little bit and then come back down.
Okay.
And so we actually decided to acclimatize on a different peak. And so we actually left base camp and climbed this other peak that goes a little bit higher than base camp, and then came back down to base camp. And then we did another rotation is what they call it, where we hiked up to camp three. There's four camps in Everest. We hiked up to camp three over a week and then came back down. And then we did our summit push, which took 5 days to go from base camp to the summit.
Okay.
So it's a lot of days. It was 47 days in all, boulder to boulder.
And I was just going to ask you, okay, so 47 days. Wow.
Which was about a month shorter than we budgeted for.
Okay.
Because we had perfect weather the whole time.
Well, that's something when you can say that.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you what may seem like a very cliched question, but I got to ask it. Since full circle, since summiting Everest, what's changed for you?
If anything. Yeah, I mean, not a lot's changed. I mean, I've had more time on my hands because I have not planned for this trip and things. But I can't say a ton has changed right away. I mean, personally, it's the summertime for me. So it was the summertime. I've just been kind of getting back to normal life, spending time with my wife. I mean, I think having a kid in the next month is going to be a little bit bigger of a change than.
Right. I was doing the math. And so I thought you're on the precipice. I'm using all these terms, these mountain terms, but you're right there on the cusp. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, I mean, I've just put more focus and energy into my family and into getting ready for this than I have. I can't say that nothing's changed incredibly a lot.
Mm-hmm. What is your family of origin, if you don't mind my asking, what have they said or what did they think about this expedition and you being a part of it?
Everyone's been really supportive. I mean, you know, when I kind of got into climbing, everyone was like, oh, there's Eddie doing all these weird things and not really understanding it. But kind of like, I've been climbing for a long time and I've been doing all these international trips here and there. And, you know, after the first couple, I think everyone's just kind of been like, okay, Eddie's going to do those things.
That's what Eddie does. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think everyone was really proud when they started seeing, you know, this little hobby that I've been doing for so long on national news. And
absolutely. And now this documentary is going to be aired. Yeah.
So, I mean, personally, it's kind of cool that there's a little bit of, I don't know, validation for things that I've been doing and that, that it is kind of more of a worthwhile thing and seen as a more of a worthwhile thing to be doing than just the basics of, you know, going to work and taking care of your family and things like that. But, so that part's been cool.
So has your coolness quotient risen in the eyes of your students at Centaurus?
Probably not. I still give them tests. I still teach them subjects they don't want to learn, you know.
I was just curious about that. You know, were there any other teachers on the climb?
Dom teaches at a university in New York. So yeah, there was one other teacher.
Yeah. I was just curious about that. If it, you know, something changed, something shifted there in your relationship, you know, with your students. So Eddie, my last question for you is this. If there is someone listening to the show, someone Black, who's interested in climbing, how would you advise them? How might they get started?
I think there's multiple ways. Obviously, a climbing gym is a really great place to start. It's indoors. Mm-hmm. It's objectively safer. You don't necessarily have to go find partners and trust in their skill level. But I think also, I mean, if you're a lot of climbing isn't just about the feet, it's about the community and about, like, you don't really go climbing by yourself. You're always climbing with other people. And so that could be a really important part and a barrier to entry for some people if they can't find a community that they feel like they fit in with or they vibe with. Mm-hmm. So a couple groups that I know locally, there's a group called Brown Girls Climb. That's a national group, but they also do some local events. There's also this group called Cruxing in Color. That's
called what? I didn't hear the
Cruxing in Color.
Got it.
It's a climbing group that they have monthly meetups for any self-identified person of color. Mm-hmm. Those are both good ways to start. The full circle, it's called Full Circle Expeditions now. Phil is kind of using our trip as kind of a beginning to a nonprofit where he's going to have some trips and clinics and things like that to try to create spaces for more people of color to kind of maybe go to Mount Kilimanjaro. That's one that he's looking at putting together. Mm-hmm. And Everest Base Camp trek is the one that he's looking at putting together, because something like Everest Base Camp, like if you're getting into climbing, you have a little bit of hiking experience and things, that's a very, very approachable thing to do. Like my sister, she's a really talented athlete, but she's not an outdoors person. Like Okay. She hasn't camped since she was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. She hasn't really went on a hike for fun for I don't know how long, but I brought her to Everest.
Right.
And like the base camp, and it pushed her, but she had a really great experience and she was able to do it. And she felt really, really empowered when she left. And mm-hmm. So hopefully she's not listening to this but no, she's a really talented athlete, but it was hard for her, but it also is something that's accessible. And that's what I know Full Circle going forward is trying to bring more an entry point for more people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what's next for you? I said that was the previous question was my last one, but it wasn't. What's next for you?
I've brought it up a couple of times, but I have this 18-year project that I'm going to start next month. So you didn't get it. Mm-mm. My kid that's coming.
Oh, when you said that, I'm thinking, what 18-year project?
It's okay. You can edit that out. You can edit that out.
No, that's okay. I'm just slow on the uptake. I'm sitting there 18 years. I don't remember him saying anything about 18 years. What 18 year project? I was paying attention. I get it. And Eddie, take it from me. It can be longer than that. But anyway, it can be longer than 18 years. But that's a project and well worthwhile. Yeah, I just didn't know if you had anything on your agenda climbing wise or what have you, especially when you mentioned Kilimanjaro. I didn't know if you might go on that expedition as well, or if that's something you've already done.
Yeah, I haven't done Kilimanjaro, but no, in terms of like the next year, I don't have a lot of big climbing goals. I'm kind of focused on doing things around the house. Also trying to build my strength up a little bit. When you spend that much time at high altitude on Everest, you lose a lot of muscle. Most people on our team came back 20, 25 pounds smaller.
I didn't know that.
It's kind of crazy. So I've been kind of just focusing on building my strength up. And I have a couple things in the rock climbing world that I want to do next season. But this season, I'm kind of just, focused on getting the house ready for the kid.
Yeah.
Getting my strength back.
Now that's wonderful. Well, Eddie Taylor, thank you so very much for spending some time with us here at KGNU on Black Talk. And somehow I feel like we're going to have to revisit. I hear what you're saying about your 18-year project, but I have a feeling something may get inserted in there. So we will revisit. But again, thank you so much. And teacher to teacher, I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful school year.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so, so much.
Everything come back around full circle. Why do lies sound pleasant, but the truth hurtful? Everybody gotta cry once in a while. But how long will it take for you smile? This is that come back to light. My pick me up and we gon' light the city up as if the sun had the night shift and paint the town red for my found there too soon.